This is Ryan Fitzpatrick, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 8 of the Neil Reynolds Podcast. I'm your host, Neil Reynolds. I hope you're enjoying the series so far. If you are, please leave us a review and a rating on iTunes. Last week, we looked at the football life of five-time NFL Executive of the Year, Scott Pioli, but we left out all of the New England Patriots stuff and saved that for this week. Teaming with Bill Belichick, Pioli built the franchise that has dominated the NFL for the past two decades. You can still go back and listen to part one, but part two is now going to see Scott take us inside the Patriots like never before. He begins by talking about Bill Belichick's approach and how that changed from his time in Cleveland and got the wheels of success turning in New England.
I think what Bill realized in Cleveland, I think he felt that he was trying to do too many things himself. And he said he wanted to do a better job of delegating, and part of it was the personnel department. But I think that it wasn't just Bill and myself. What happened when we moved from, when we went up to New England, Bill brought with him a couple of very close confidants in myself, Ernie Adams, and a guy by the name of Bears Najarian. And then he was able to put in a coaching staff of people that were not only really good coaches, but they knew Bill and they understood Bill. Romeo Crennel became the defensive coordinator. Charlie Weiss was the offensive coordinator. You know, one of the things that was different in this move for Bill to New England was he was surrounded with people that knew him, believed in him, did a lot of the same things, you know, very much the same. And similarly, even though we were different personalities, we believed in a lot of the same core values. That being said, what we knew we wanted to do a little bit differently was we focused more on building a team rather than just trying to collect a bunch of really good and talented players. Bill is, in certain ways, you know, Bill's obviously brilliant. I mean, if there's such a thing as football genius, he has it. However, there's certain other things about Bill that are incredibly simple and basic. And some of his he had three basic rules that all he cared about that he had for players: be on time, pay attention, work hard. So what we needed to do was to make sure that we had a building full of people that believed in Bill and those three values and loved the game. Bill's love and passion and respect, that's what people don't always think about too. Bill's respect for the game of football is as strong as anybody I've ever been around. And people who didn't know how to be professionals, in his mind, in my mind, were disrespecting the game. So what we did is we set out to have talented players, but also players that had equal respect, love, and passion for winning, and were more selfless than they were selfish. So what we did is, you know, again, you know, I go back to it, is that the 2000 season, our first season there, we were 5-11. But what people don't always, there's a lot of revisionist history that I read about and hear about from people that weren't even there on how we did what we did. And I think what people don't really realize is we signed 23 free agent players prior to the 2001 season. And no team had ever been built on free agency before. But what we did is we went out and signed a lot of veteran players who believed in the things that Bill Belichick believed in.
Some of those free agents included the likes of Mike Vrabel, the current head coach of the Tennessee Titans, a linebacker with four seasons of experience with the Steelers. He may not have been a headline player at that time, but from relative obscurity in Pittsburgh, Vrabel would help the Patriots win three Super Bowls, buying into the principles instilled by Belichick and Pioli.
Now, Mike Vrabel was not a household name back then. Mike Vrabel was a backup defensive lineman who had played 4 years for the Pittsburgh Steelers, mostly on special teams and a couple of reps on defense. You know, Roman Pfeiffer was a guy that no one knew about. Anthony Pleasant, Bobby Hamilton, Mark Edwards, Matt Stevens, you know, Jermaine Wiggins, Joe Andrewsy, Mike Compton. All these guys that were, again, perceived by a lot of people to be average to above average football players. But going back to whether you're a general manager or a vice president of player personnel, whatever your role is, if you're the person responsible for finding players, you have to put all of your personal desires aside and understand that the players that you're bringing in are the players that best fit your head coach from a scheme standpoint, from a makeup standpoint, talking about an emotional makeup standpoint, and who they are is just as important as what they are as players. We brought in a bunch of players that believed in Bill and approached the game and were hard workers, were grinders, were people who were always going to be on time, pay attention, work hard. And that's, you know, I only mentioned a handful of the names that I know I'm missing a bunch. Antoine Smith, that running back, I mean, he had 1,000 yards that first Super Bowl season. They were all guys that believed and loved the game and loved their teammates as much as Bill and the rest of us did.
I guess that one thing you just mentioned there, you often credited with building a team, and it is a team, right? It's not a collection of individuals. They're not trading cards.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's funny, people now, when you look back and you remember this because you're such a fan of the game and supporter of the game, you know, that year we were told our guys loved each other on a level that I hadn't been associated with, quite honestly, as a team since the high school team I had been a part of that won a state championship, or we were undefeated my junior year of high school. There was a bond between these players unlike anything I had seen in my several years in the NFL. They came together and they were doing everything as a team. And it was truly, we were beating teams that were more talented than us, had more, because again, this is a team game, right? When you have those 11 on the field, it's 11 interdependent relationships, Neil, and no one can do their job if the other person isn't doing their job. The only way that you succeed in a play is if everyone is doing their job. And if a couple of people are deviating and not doing their job, you're not going to be able to have success in an individual play. And this team loved one another. And I go back to that Super Bowl. We got into this thing. The players just started doing it on their own very naturally. They didn't want to see individuals announced before the game, right? So what used to happen back then is, you know, they'd either the starting offense or the starting defense. And the players were actually internally getting pissed off that they were like, well, I don't want to be introduced as an individual. And then somebody got this idea and they're like, you know, screw it. We're going to run out as a team when they announce starting quarterback Tom Brady. We're all going to run out. And that's what they did. And it became part of the identity. And that crazy moment in the middle of the season actually bonded the team even more. And as we got to the playoffs, the league warned us that because the league has their protocol, right? And at the Super Bowl, you know, they've got all these people that are much more important than the people actually doing the game. The marketing and people want to say, listen, we're going to introduce every team, every player individually, and if you guys do that team thing and come running out, you know, and blow the time schedule, we've got thing. You know, they had everything timed out, and it's like,
I bet that fell on deaf ears.
Oh, our players! I'll tell you what. I know this is a podcast, and the listeners can't see me right now, but there were a lot of hand gestures in that team meeting when Bill told the team what was going to go on, and Bill was like kind of rolling his eyes and go, listen, I got to tell you guys, you're not allowed to do this. And they're all like, ah, you know. Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of hand gestures. And before the game, they just said, again, I hope I can say that, they just said, screw it, and they ran out as a team. Yeah. And it was this, I'll never forget, because again, knowing the background story, it was this magical moment that, again, we have this saying, it's not the best 53, it's the right 53, because individuals go to Pro Bowls and teams win championships. What are you in this for? Are you in it to win championships or go off to Hawaii by yourself with your family, maybe a couple of friends? Which one is more satisfying?
Scott Pioli worked with Belichick at the Browns, the Jets, and the Patriots over the course of 17 seasons, so he knows the legendary coach better than pretty much anyone else in the NFL. But for someone like me in the media, I see a different side to the coach, a public image that is very guarded and a man who doesn't want to give much away. He doesn't give you extra. As the journalist, you have to get your question right. He's not going to finish the job for you. He'll answer what you ask, but you better ask it the right way. As I found out the year the Patriots went to the Super Bowl against the Falcons, I was asking about comebacks, and I mentioned a comeback the previous year, and he shut it down straight away, telling me that he wasn't going to talk about last season. Thankfully, I got to ask the question again, mention the comebacks in that current season, but it showed he's a man who's very much to the point. But Scott sees a different Belichick, a coach who is willing to help people and who is good-hearted.
He's like every other person. You know, he has a heart. He has compassion. He has, I have my opinions that are very, very strong about him because he and I were friends before I worked with him. I also saw him turn things on and turn things off. You know, we have summer homes near one another, so I've seen him during the downtime of the season. You know, I've seen him around his family over the years, during the entire growth of his children and their lives. And it's the media and the public see him in these public settings, right? And part of Bill's job is, it's his job, right? His job, his profession is to win football games. That's what he has to do. So everything that he does in and around his team and that involves his team, he demands those things of his players. But part of his greatness is that he sets an example and sets a tone that everything that he does, there's not a player that's ever played for him that can say, you know what, coach, you did something here that might have compromised us winning a game, or you said something or you behaved a certain way that might compromise us winning a game. Bill's thought when he has to be public, he's smart enough to know that anything and everything that he does in a public forum can be consumed in a certain way. Mm. You know, Neil, you made a very smart choice because in the question asking, because you hit the nail on the head. Bill, he doesn't suffer fools. And he believes in respecting the game, the game's history. He loves the game of football. And he never saw it as entertainment. He saw it as a game. He saw it as winning and losing and strategy. It wasn't about how many fans were in the stadium. It wasn't about how much money he was going to get paid. Did those things evolve? Yes, he did, but he didn't demand. He'd be doing this job if he was making $40,000 a year. He didn't demand that the game was going to change and that the rewards financially were going to change. He's never looked at it as entertainment. Now, he's gotten smart enough to know, and he is smart enough to know, that it has become entertainment, but he's not going to let the entertainment component, again, undo all the other things. He is not going to eat the cheese, as we say, and fall into the trap of becoming, a rock star without a concert, is what we used to say.
Well, yeah, I interviewed him. I interviewed him in 2009, I think, in midfield in Gillette Stadium during training camp. They brought me inside because he didn't do many one-on-ones and they didn't want the local guys to see that I was doing a one-on-one with him. And I was kind of sniffing around the whole time, trying to get a line where he would tell me Tom Brady was one of the greatest of all time. And he just didn't want to. He didn't take that cheese, Scott.
But here's where it's interesting. Not only will he not say it about Tom Brady, he's not going to allow you to say that about him, that he's the greatest head coach of all time.
Win, right?
And again, that's the thing, is the rules apply for Bill. The same rules that he puts on other people apply to him also. And that's an important part of his coaching, because he doesn't see himself as above anybody. And again, I'll tell you this, one of the most interesting things when I first worked for him in Cleveland, I was what they called a slappy, right? It was that was the affectionate term that they gave us, or the title. And we did anything and everything. And there was no job that I ever saw. There were certain coaches that were either coordinators or position coaches. They were too busy to run their own copies on the copy machine. They were too busy to get their own coffee. They were too busy to, there were certain things that they wouldn't do, right? Bill, anything and everything that he asked people to do at times, he was willing to do himself. And I can't tell you how many times I would go to the copy machine. We had this, it was back in the day. This was 1992, and we had one that did double siding and it did collating. It stapled things. It's like we called it the Queen Mary. It was the greatest copying machine in the history of copy machines at that point in time. And I can't tell you how many times I would go to that copy machine and have to wait in line because Bill was running his own copies. And there's something to that, Neil. And I think that that's an element of leadership when you show people that you're not being treated as a different class of citizen. I'm going to do the work right along with you, and there's nothing that's above me or below me, and that's how I want you, regardless of what your role or your title is, to approach your job.
Pioli was in the war room the night the Patriots drafted Tom Brady in 2000. We talked about what Scott did and didn't see in Brady. We now know him as the greatest player in NFL history, but back then he was waiting until pick 199 to hear his name called by the New England Patriots.
It's important, as I mentioned, some people's revisionist history is amazing at times. And, you know, the 2000 draft was, you know, there were, obviously we didn't draft him until the sixth round, but what was important about that is the background of that team. When we arrived that first season at the New England Patriots, as it was going on schedule, we only had 41 players under contract, and we were scheduled to be $10.5 million over the cap. So the first order of business in January of 2000 when we got there was to get under the salary cap and put a roster together. And by the time we got down under the salary cap, what the salary cap number was going to be, we had only 39 players under contract. And oh, by the way, by the time you go to training camp, you have to have 80 players. And what we did when we cleaned up the roster and got the cap where we needed to be was we were able to look at the roster. And the one position, Neil, that we were very strong at was quarterback. We had Drew Bledsoe as the starting quarterback. The backup was John Fries. And Michael Bishop, who was a young, very talented quarterback out of Kansas State. So we had three players. If we had to line up and play a game at that moment, we didn't even have a tight end we could line up and play with. We didn't even have, you know, we didn't even have enough players to line up 11 on each side and maybe even punt the ball or kick the ball off. So the as we went to the draft, you know, you go into this situation and you rank players in two different ways. And what you do is you create your draft board and you put the graded player goes horizontally in columns, right? You have a horizontal grade between 7.0 and 6.5, and then vertically you list the players at a certain position. Then you also stack a second board with all the same names, best player in order 1 through 50, 51 through 100. So anyway, I'm giving that background because, you know, Tommy was a player that we actually, Brady was a player that we started talking about in and around the fourth round. We really liked the player. We had spent a lot of time on him, but again, there was not much of a need at that position. And, you know, that pick to me was one of the best collaborative decisions that I've seen a group of people make. You know, so I didn't draft Tom Brady. Bill didn't draft Tom Brady. You know, Charlie Weiss didn't. Bobby Greer didn't. What it was there was a group of people. We had done a lot of work on the player. I had actually seen him play the year before, his senior year, up at Syracuse. Michigan was playing. I was on the road that week doing a Buffalo Bills advanced scout. So I saw him in person. But we also, our offensive coaches spent quite a bit of time. And one of the people that deserves a great deal of credit in drafting Tommy is Dick Rabine. God rest his soul. Dick was our quarterback's coach at the time in 2000 and 2001. Dick, we sent him out to work Tom out at Michigan and did a private workout with him. And again, what we were concerned about his tools initially, right? Because he was tall, long, didn't have great overall coordination at the time. He was a young player, right? He still didn't have full control of his body. He wasn't very strong at the time. But what he did have was very good accuracy, and he had a mind that was incredible and work habits and a work ethic that was off the charts. And we spent time with him. We saw him at the East-West Shrine practices that year also because he played in that game. But Dick Rabine took a liking to him. Charlie liked him. Ernie Adams liked him. I liked him. But everyone liked him. But the problem was we didn't need a quarterback. So we talked about him at the beginning in the fourth round. And then in the fifth round, we're talking about him again. And we're saying, you know, why is anyone picking him? Do we have a bad evaluation on this guy? Because he was starting to separate himself all the way by the board. By the time we got to the sixth round, I think it was a couple picks right before Brady. We even drafted Antoine Harris a couple of picks, who was a corner, because we looked at Antoine Harris. Okay, this is a guy who could play the slot corner position, but he can also play special teams. We know that if we draft this guy, he's going to get reps for us. You know, if we draft Brady, He's going to be sitting the bench behind Drew. Will that be a wasted pick? Anyway, we drafted Harrison. Then after that, we drafted Brady. And you know, the rest is history. There's a lot more to that, but the rest is history.
Yeah.
Was he, in a way, the perfect Patriot? Because I remember interviewing him, again, another one-on-one I did with Tom Brady in 2012. I asked, what's your favorite Super Bowl? And he said, the next one. And I think about your team and Coach Belichick, yourself, the classic example of a team hitting reset from year to year was, so in many ways, was he the perfect Patriot?
You know, Neil, that is a beautiful question, and I'll tell you why. Because that was our attitude and our culture at the New England Patriots. That's what we were trying to build. But that response that Brady gave you when you asked him, what is your favorite, you know, Super Bowl? He said the next one. When he got there, he told the story of the equipment manager at the University of Michigan. This is a true story. He would talk about the equipment manager who had been there for 100 years, who always used to, you know, he kept all of his rings, his Rose Bowl rings, his Big Ten championship. He kept them. And I never forget Brady telling the story that whenever someone asked the equipment manager, what's your favorite ring? And he would always look up and say, the next one. So Brady had that mindset. And that was something that he heard someone else say, but resonated with him personally, that was part of who he was. So he naturally came to us as, you know, the same personality. Because if you ask Bill, that's Bill's, you know, that's Bill's answer. That's my answer. That's Ernie Adams' answer. That's Charlie. So it was the perfect fit in so many ways. And Neil, you know, going back to Tommy, you know, I mentioned the thing about him, his selflessness is on a level of, I think I only know one other player, Anthony Pleasant, who played for us on those championship teams as a defensive lineman. The completely different personalities, but a degree of selflessness in terms of being more concerned about the greater good in your teammates on a level unlike anybody that I've ever been. Tommy walked away from tens of millions of dollars over the course of his career, even at a very young age, to make sure that the organization would take his cap space that he left on the table, that he could have taken, in order for the team to build a better team and have more great players around him.
Now, we see general managers looking on anxiously as games play out below them every Sunday. So how helpless does someone like Scott feel as a general manager when an undefeated season is snatched from a team like it was with New England in 2007 or Atlanta in Super Bowl 51 when Tom Brady begins that historic comeback? To us, it looks like he's built the team but cannot do anything about it.
But you can, and that's a very delicate and fine line, Neil, and it's a great question, because in that moment, there's nothing that you can do personally. The truth is, there's nothing in that moment that the head coach can do once the play is in and once the play is going to be executed, and that's part of the beauty of football. And you have to be careful. You can't remove yourself or recuse yourself from responsibility for things when they don't go right. If you're going to be around for, you know, the bouquets when they're being thrown to you after success, you know, what's that saying? Success has many fathers and failure is an orphan. I know that saying because I don't like people who live that lifestyle. So even though I was not on the field and not in a position to do anything to help Rodney Harrison, who was not responsible for that, I want to be on the record, that was not Rodney, even though he was the player closest to it. There was another player that was responsible for what happened there. You know, you feel in certain moments that there's nothing that you could do at that moment. However, I always look back at that and say to myself, what could I have done prior to that game, the week before, 2 weeks before, the month earlier, to give us some sort of competitive advantage where it didn't come down to that game, to that play. So it's a very fine line. And people who stand back, and this is, goes back to the whole team thing, Neil. If you're in, you're in. If you're not in, then get out. And it's just one of those things where anybody who's part of the team that sits back and says, well, you know, yeah, that happened, but I had no control over that. At some point in time, if you're part of that team, you had a control of something that, or you had an opportunity to be a part of making a better decision or a different decision that would have led to a success in another moment.
So there's my conversation, well, two conversations with Scott Pioli. Lots of great stories from that five-time NFL Executive of the Year. Hope you enjoyed those. Let's bring in producer Gary Hayes for the mailbag. What questions have you got for us this week, Gary?
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me on again. Yeah, I just want to start with a question from Benjamin Newbury. He asks, when did your interest in the NFL begin and what made you want to be a presenter or a reporter covering the NFL?
So I became a fan of the NFL probably in the early 83, 84. My dad was watching it a lot. My dad was a 49ers fan. Loved Joe Montana, like watching John Riggins for the Redskins. So I gradually became more interested in the sport and didn't really think about TV at all for many, many years. I mean, I've told this story before. I was a journalist first, written journalist from 1991. Started kind of working full-time on a newspaper called First Down in 1997, but didn't really look at TV until I got made redundant from NFL Europe in 2006. So I thought I'd give the Sky Sports stuff a go. So it was quite a while before I sort of veered into television. It certainly wasn't a plan, just kind of happened that way. It was more about having an outlet for talking about the NFL and having a passion for the NFL. That's why I enjoyed doing radio as well. I worked on BBC Radio 5 Live. I just wanted to carry on covering the NFL however I could, and TV just happened to be that medium.
And now here you are doing podcasts.
And podcasts, yes, absolutely.
So another question is from Ross Henderson. I think he's been tapping into our phone lines because the interview over these two episodes was pretty long with Scott, which is why we did it over two. And he's asking, what's the longest interview you've ever done?
Scott might be up there. What was it, about an hour and 20 minutes?
I think it was longer than that, wasn't it? We had to cut a lot out.
Yeah, well, I think it was. That's got to be right up there. I mean, when you think about it, I'd get a lot of interviews done during training camps. And so the most you get, and you'll feel pretty fortunate if you get that, because, you know, I get a 10-minute one-on-one with a head coach, with the quarterback, and you feel fortunate to get that because most of the beat reporters in those cities aren't getting one-on-ones with the head coach. They get a press conference or they do a little group chat. So you kind of feel glad to get those. But then it's when you get extra, you know, players coming over to spend time on NFL UK live tours with me or PR tours around the country. And then you get a bit more extended time. I would say Ray Lewis would be one that comes to mind. Probably interviewed Ray for about 50 minutes and could have run through a brick wall after that. He's such a motivational guy. But generally, you're looking at most interviews being 10 minutes. So Scott would be right up there. We did Kurt Warner for the podcast. It's going to be for a future episode. That was about an hour. That's a lot of talking though. So, you know, you can get a lot of your stuff in 10, 15 minutes. But obviously if you want to dig deeper, you get a bit longer.
And I think because the ones we're doing here, I think we're really privileged to be getting the time spent with these guys. Because yeah, it normally is 10 to 15 minutes, like you say. So when you get that time, you really get those stories like we've had with Scott.
Right. And it's quite an art. So it is that, you know, and that's what I want to get. And I am going to commit to getting, a lot of active players involved in this, but it's a bigger ask for an active player, you know, to get an interview set up. You know, we've got some good ones coming up. We've got Lamar Jackson has agreed to do the podcast with us, Kirk Cousins, Raheem Mostert. But it's a lot to ask for that sort of time from a current player. So, we'll have to sweet talk them, but we'll get it done.
Okay, last question this week is from Tom Forster. Tom asks, which I think is a really interesting question, moving away from media questions and whatnot. He asks, a lot is made of the quarterback position in draft and team selection. He mentions Trubisky over Mahomes and Watson as an example. Mm-hmm. But how much is talent over team and system considered? So could we be talking about Trubisky differently if he hooked up with Andy Reid at Kansas City?
I get that argument, and I think it helps if you're in a good situation and you're surrounded by the right coaching. But I think for the truly special players, I don't think it's a factor. I think if Mahomes had gone to the Chicago Bears, he would still be the Patrick Mahomes we are seeing now. And I think Trubisky might be disappointing the Kansas City Chiefs if the roles were reversed. I think it's players, when you're looking at elite players, I think players trump a scheme. I think as you go through different positions and different times in players' careers, players tell me all the time, well, I wasn't in the right place at the right time. They had too many running backs on the roster, or it wasn't a good fit for me from a scheme point of view. But for the most part, I don't buy that argument. I think Patrick Mahomes is clearly a much greater quarterback than Mitchell Trubisky, and that would have shown itself wherever Mahomes played and wherever Trubisky played. So I think Mahomes is the best player in the NFL now, and I think he would be wherever he was playing.
I, for one, love him.
Love him?
Like everyone else does. Oh, he's amazing. I don't know my NFL, but I know my Patrick Mahomes.
I tell you what, Gary, that is a fantastic place to leave this episode because I don't need to know any more details. So we're back on July the 17th, right?
That's right. And who are we speaking to?
We have a good friend of mine, dear friend of mine. We're going back into the media world. So we have Dan Hansus from the Around the NFL podcast. So Dan is a regular on our Sky Sports show. All four of the heroes are a regular on our Sky Sports shows. They are hugely popular among our UK fan base. So we're gonna hear Dan's football story. So, looking forward to that one. So that's on July the 17th. Please make sure you listen to all the episodes if you haven't done so far. Give us a rating and a review. You can even reach out to me at Neil Reynolds NFL on Twitter and tell me what you like about the podcast and what you don't like if you like. But I'd rather just know what you like. We'll see you next time. Bye for now. This episode was hosted by myself, Neil Reynolds. Our producer is Gary Hayes, while Matt Alabaster is responsible for all of our artwork. Taylor Hayes mixed this episode and also composed our theme music. Special thanks to junior producer Henry Smith and everyone else involved in helping us put this episode together. The Neil Reynolds Podcast is a Highway 61 production for the Reynolds Podcast Network.